A Listener Production.
This is From Zero, conversations with business founders. I'm Adam Schwab, co-founder of LuxuryEscapes.com, financial journalist, author, and angel investor. With my best mate from school, we co-founded Luxury Escapes, and the business has grown to turn over almost $1 billion annually. In this episode, you ask me the questions in what we call Ask Adam Anything. If you're a budding entrepreneur, established founder, or business professional and want to ask us a question, please send a voice recording to info@fromzeropodcast.com, and we'd love to get you on the show. Now, on to our first question.
I have two questions. The first would be, what do you think is the most overrated trait that is valued by investors? And the second would be, what's your advice to a young Aussie startup that's just done a seed round and then they see a direct competitor in the States raise a monster round? What piece of wisdom do you have?
Thank you for that great question. A great two-part question, I should say. So I'll answer your first question first. What is the most overrated trait that is valued by investors? Well, I think probably the most undervalued or the most important trait, and I've spoken about it on the pod before, is without doubt grit. And that's what most investors, the most smart early stage investors are looking for. And the reason is pretty simple, in that ideas are pretty cheap. And what counts is execution and the ability to pivot on the idea when things get tough and the ideas, and if you just don't get product market fit. Most great businesses have pivoted multiple times. If you look at the world's most valuable business, Apple, that's done a number of pivots from personal computers to, of course, when Steve Jobs came back, got rid of most products, and of course, famously created the iPod and then the iPhone, and of course, Tim Cook has continued that legacy. So the ability to pivot and be gritty is a super important trait. A trait that's overrated is probably storytelling or the ability to create a narrative. And we've seen that over the past. We've seen an incredible bubble in anywhere from startup to even listed high growth companies. And you see it in everything. And there's been a great adjustment, probably an 80% adjustment for most publicly listed high growth businesses in both the US and Australia. And what we haven't seen though is an adjustment in private company valuations. You see a lot of businesses getting incredible valuations on sort of 100, 200, 500 times revenue on the basis of the CEO founder being a great storyteller. And Scott Galloway talks about this, and it's the market in a bubble period changes from being, from looking at fundamentals, so looking at things like EBITDA and cash flow. And ultimately the value of a business eventually becomes the present value of its cash flows. So ultimately all businesses have to spin off cash and make money. But in a bubble, investors stop looking at that and stop looking at a business's ability to make money and start focusing on the narrative. And Travis Kalanick was a classic one. He was just an incredible storyteller at Uber and was able to raise billions of dollars. Actually, an even better example is Adam Newman from WeWork. And I think if you look at peak startup, that was probably 3 years ago when WeWork was valued at $47 billion by SoftBank. And it was never a real valuation because SoftBank was the only investor in the last three rounds. So it kept bidding itself up in the vain hope it would be able to goose investors in a public listing. Sadly, investors were too smart for Adam Newman and SoftBank, and it ended up listing for $8.5 billion US this year, which was a much more reasonable valuation. But what Adam Newman was able to do was create this incredible story around WeWork being a tech business. I think he called himself real estate as a service or property as a service. And clearly what WeWork was a business that rented long and then sold short. So it would enter into these long-term leases and they would enter into short-term kind of call it licenses with people who wanted to rent space. And that's to say it's actually become a pretty solid business. There's some really well-run businesses, not only in Australia, but around the world that follow that model. But Adam Newman took it to the nth degree in that he tried to claim what was essentially a property business was a tech business, and it wasn't, but he was amazing at telling a story. So the overrated trait is how good is an executive at telling a story. And I see some competitors of ours who are great at telling stories. And I've been helping out. I'm an investor in a business in the alternative food space that creates vegan foods. And I would regularly speak, and this is a very talented founder who I really liked. And he ended up getting a really good valuation on the business, but he wanted an even higher valuation. And I'd spend many conversations telling him, don't worry what other people are raising at. The fact that a worse business was raising at a valuation of $100 million doesn't mean you need to be raising at $150 million. Raise at the valuation that's right for you and for your business, and get a valuation that rewards investors for the risk they're taking. And he probably raised at a slightly higher valuation, but he was much more tempered in what they were looking at originally, and that allowed him to get money in the business and survive and keep growing. So clearly there has been a problem that is starting to get unwound, but we still see many early stage investors, and this really harks back to how VCs work, and VCs are more interested in getting that 100 bagger that makes the fund. VCs want a Canva, or VCs want an Uber, or they want an Apple. They don't necessarily want, it's very different to angel investing. As an angel, what you're essentially trying to do is get a 100% return. But a VC often wants a 10,000% return to return the fund. So VCs are often very inclined to believe the storyteller over the fundamentals. And that's why a lot of VCs who simply just do basic pattern recognition on industry and then back the person who tells the best story. I think we saw with SoftBank, who simply tried to throw capital at businesses and essentially failed, that simply backing stories over backing real businesses is where so many investors go wrong. So I guess as a founder, look for that. So you want to try and show that you can make money as a business, maybe not this year or next year, but the business has product market fit and is capable of making money. Second part of the question, what's my advice to a startup who sees a competitor raise a bunch of money in the States? And it's kind of linked to your first. We've had competitors over the years, both locally and globally. And what we've always tried to do is just focus on ourselves. It's really easy to be distracted by companies that are raising $100, $200, $500 billion valuations. When you're hacking away with bootstrap money, and ultimately you can't control what competitors are doing. And often being bootstrapped can be an advantage. If you raise a bunch of money, a business who raises a bunch of money tends to waste that money. Not always, but often. They'll spend too much on people. They'll hire too many people. They'll overbid for keywords. They'll do stupid things and create lots of really bad habits. And we were bootstrapped till very recently, till a few months ago. And we bootstrapped our way to more than $500 million in sales. And we were always really disciplined. The disadvantage of that is you grow a bit slower. You're not going to grow 20x a year, or very hard to grow 20x a year, unless you either capture this incredible flywheel of network effects, but that's unusual, not many Instagrams. But most bootstrap companies have to grow a bit more conservatively because you're only investing in marketing money you have. So the fact that you're bootstrapped, you obviously sound like a really sensible founder, you're doing the right things. If a business overseas raise a bunch of money, don't try and copy what they do when you're bootstrapped, because you'll end up just going bust. So be responsible, focus on cash flows, focus on raising that next round, but don't be too distracted by the shiny competitor, because chances are they'll flame out. Many do, most do. And you just stick to your own race and be disciplined and find that product market fit, and you'll have a great business.
Hey, Adam. Loving the show. Ryan here from London in the UK. We've got a business that's expanding really well, really nicely. We've bootstrapped it and are getting to kind of that next level of growth where we could hit accelerate, but not sure whether we're going to raise some capital, whether we go to the bank, ask them for a few dollars, or we just kind of keep bootstrapping, reinvesting the cash, but we're sort of growing a bit quicker than that. We're also looking at an acquisition and kind of pondering the same questions, whether we debt finance it, go and raise some equity finance, or we could pay for it just straight out of cash reserves, but not really sure what direction to take to kind of keep facilitating the growth. And it'd be great to hear your thoughts, mate. Look forward to hearing them. Cheers.
Thank you, Ryan from London. You don't sound very English, but you sound like you're an outstanding young entrepreneur. Some really great questions. I love the fact that you've bootstrapped a business that sounds like what is a really good scale. So congratulations for that, and well done on your journey so far. And the question you ask is so relevant for so many people. The fact that you have the option to keep bootstrapping shows that you're actually in a really good place. And what you always want to be raising capital when you don't need it. And it sounds like you're in that position now. So it probably is a good time to raise capital. But the real question is, if you're going to raise capital and don't need it, is should you? And so the Obviously, the upside of raising capital is you can get cash in the business. And this is capital or debt, I should say. And we'll talk about the split in a second. But the clear upside of raising capital is you can grow faster. So let's say you've got a business that's it's worth $1 million, for argument's sake. And if you can get another $500,000 in, if that business can be worth $10 million in 2 years rather than $3 million, then it's almost certainly worth getting that capital in. It's worth copping what we call dilution because you're going to grow the business tenfold. So it's worth copping a 50% dilution. So the real question is can you reinvest that money very profitably at a, what we call a really high return on equity? If you can, then it's absolutely worth looking at getting capital in. We can talk about how in a second. If you can't, so if you're getting $500,000 in and simply going to grow at the same rate, then it's pointless. Don't dilute yourself for no reason. And the other thing to remember is when you're getting sort of capital or certainly debt as well, is there comes responsibilities with that. If you've been bootstrapped since the beginning, you're not beholden to outside investors. You're not beholden to people telling you what to do, to being liable to a board, to having to account to directors through reporting every 3 months or 6 months. So there is a lot, and with debt, it's even worse. Debt, you can have covenants. So if, for example, you borrow money, they may require a certain level of EBITDA or revenue. If you don't hit that, the bank can make you repay the money or have other onerous terms. So you're not giving up the farm to do it, but there are absolutely negatives to allowing debt and equity. But obviously the positive is you do get cash and also give you a chance to potentially take money out of the business. It's what we call secondary. So primary is money coming in and secondary is money coming out. So secondary is a great way to often people like yourself aren't paying yourself much, especially if you're bootstrapped. So getting secondary money out, it's great from a tax perspective. You pay less tax on capital gains than you do income. But it's also good to be able to buy a house or diversify your risk a bit. But I'm digressing a little bit. So the real question there is, should you take the money, then how do you take it? And that really is how fast can you grow? In terms of the second question, it's a really good, again, that's really a two-part question. Talking about A, should you do an acquisition? And B, how should you finance acquisition? So really two questions in one. Should you do it? It's the fact that you're in a position to be able to do an acquisition is a really good thing. Most businesses don't get that ability till later in life. Data shows that about 90% of acquisitions fail. When I say fail, they don't cover the cost. So prima facie, most acquisitions are bad. Does that mean you shouldn't do it? No. But it means you got to think really carefully. And us as a business, one of our early businesses called deals.com was in a sector that was naturally declining. So we tried to get over that natural declination through constant acquisitions. We had a really smart guy called Josh who was our COO, who had worked at Insight Venture Capital. He was a really good M&A guy. So he'd go out and find lots of really great targets. And he's really great at identifying businesses and negotiating the deals and then at integrating them. The problem that we had, and this was no fault of Josh's or it was a fault of all of ours collectively, was you tend to overstate the benefit acquisitions. That's why 90% fail, is people, A, pay too much, or B, if you don't pay too much, you understate the amount of work needed to be done. So of the 15 or 16 acquisitions we did, probably one or two worked really well. Three or four were probably neutral, and the rest were either really bad or completely terrible. And we bought a business at one point, an e-commerce business. So we were a business, we had multiple businesses in our business. We had a travel business, of course, which is now Luxury Escapes. We had a product business, which we since sold, and a local business. And both the local and product businesses weren't at scale. So we bought a bigger product business in the hope that we'd be able to rescue our business through more scale. The problem is when you buy a business, as Warren Buffett says, you're much better off buying a good business for a fair price than a shit business for a cheap price. And there's a good reason for that, is because good businesses continue to perform well and bad businesses get worse. And we saw that in a number of ways. A, the business you buy, if it's a poorly performing business, tends to worsen. And the second point is you have a massive distraction in getting that business right. So instead of focusing on our great business, our travel business, we'll focus on this terrible product business. So we had to spend 10, 20, 30% of our development resource trying to fix and integrate this e-commerce business. Had we been building new features for our travel business, we would have been far, far better off. So a business that cost us, we gave 8% equity away to buy this business. That equity is probably worth four, five, six times now. Plus, we had a huge opportunity cost in dev resources that could have been used for our travel business in this other business. So we estimate that acquisition that we thought would cost us about $10 million has probably cost us $100 million. So the cost of that was really significant. And then we had other businesses we bought that were just terrible little businesses. We took a bit of time, we wasted a bit of money, or maybe it cost us a couple million bucks, and we then realized our mistake pretty quickly and killed it. So in general, most businesses, most acquisitions fail. The exception to that really is bolt-ons. So if you've got an existing business, let's say you're a business in the ride-sharing sector, and you've got an already existing business, and you buy a piece of technology or you acquire some really good young founder to get their technology, get the founder in your business, maybe get a few customers along the way and give that founder a bit of equity. That can be a really good way to do it, or a customer acquisition add-on, or what we call bolt-on. So if you've got a million customers and a great platform, and you see a little platform that's got 100,000 customers with a terrible platform, putting those customers on your platform for a really cheap price is another really good acquisition. So you're getting, it's effectively not a company buyer, it's buying customers. They're the two really limited sort of forms of acquisitions that tend to work pretty well. Outside that, I've rarely seen an acquisition work well. The main reasons that the company, especially public companies, do acquisitions is because it gives the CEO a bigger empire and they can pay themselves more. They generally don't think about shareholders, they think about themselves. So in most cases, and that's the reason, and on the public markets, when a company buys another company, usually the acquirer share drops and the target share increases, because it's simply, it's a value shift from purchaser to seller. Same applies in the private space as well. The private space is just a smaller, earlier version of the public space. So I'm always very careful of acquisitions in general. In terms of how you fund it, that's kind of neutral. Whether you fund it from debt, equity, or cash flows, the cost is really the same. That's a fundamental tenet of business finance. The bigger question is, should you do the acquisition or not? Once you decide to do it, obviously, as we talked about before, raising debt or issuing equity has a significant cost. Obviously, it's much easier to use your existing cash flows if you can. If you can't and you really want to do the acquisition, I think for startups, getting equity is generally safer than debt, because the covenants attaching to debt are usually really serious. So first question is, should you do the acquisition? Be really careful on that. If you really want to do it, if it's a great acquisition, I'd use cash flows first, effectively bootstrap the acquisition. If you can't, then equity is probably your next best bet. And if you can't do that, then look at debt, but it's raising the risk each time. So be super careful. But thanks for your question and good luck with your journey.
Hi, Adam. It's Andrew here from London. I work in private equity finance. I am currently doing an executive MBA at Cambridge, and I spend a lot of my time researching NFTs, or non-fungible tokens, to invest in. So the reason I'm mentioning all of this is because I don't have a lot of time spare, and I require quite a lot of energy and focus throughout the day. Now, I know you've actually built a pretty impressive business, so could you provide us with some tips that are unconventional, maybe, on how to increase our overall energy levels? So I think everyone knows that good sleep provides that. But, you know, is there anything out of the ordinary that really moved the needle for you? That would be great to hear your advice on that.
Andrew from London, we've got a cadre of London listeners, which is fantastic. Doing an MBA and working in private equity, so you've done, obviously, a super smart guy who's done incredibly well. And I think the fact that you're asking these kind of questions is just an indicator of how good a business person you'll be when you do eventually start your own business or work in the private equity space. And I love the question. Not much time, needs energy and focus. What are some tips that I do? And I guess the thing about me, so I tend to get up pretty early, partly because I've got youngish kids. So I tend to get up about 5 a.m. I tend to go to bed at about 10. So I try, as you said, try and maintain that six and a half, seven hours. It's super macho to be that sort of 3-4 hours sleep. Investment banker, go to bed at 2, wake up at 6. I'm not sure that's healthy. Certainly the experts seem to agree that sort of 7 hours is really the minimum to get. 8 hours, to me, 8 hours is starting to get toppy. I think at 8 hours, I actually start feeling tired again. So I think sort of seven and a quarter hours is really a sweet spot. And ensuring you have really, if you can, really good sleep. I'm lucky enough, I don't take sort of those sleeping tablets or anything like that, but I've heard melatonin is a good option as a natural remedy. But yeah, getting that right amount of sleep is really critical. But I tend to have a pretty good plan of what I'm going to do during the day. So I'll get up at 5. I'll try and exercise from 5:30 sort of 5:30 to 6:30, be it a run, be it jumping on the Peloton, or how do you know someone's got a Peloton? Well, don't worry, they'll tell you. So I'll jump on the Peloton, case in point, and then I'll have it at golf, and I'll try and be done exercise wise by 7. Try and help with the kids, or my wife usually does most of that stuff, but I'm at least around, which can be helpful. And I'll try and be done exercise wise by 7. And I actually do an 18-6 fast, which has become intermittent fasting, which has become super popular now. I actually find it's really good. I get less hungry fasting than not fasting, as long as I've exercised. So I'll generally eat lunch at about 1 o'clock and have dinner at about 7 o'clock. So get that 18 hours in. I find that's really energizing. Good for weight, good for digestion, good for just feeling lively. Because I'm a bit boring, I don't drink alcohol. When I used to drink alcohol, I'd try not to drink much at night because A, it's not great for sleep, and B, it's terrible to exercise. Your performance is shocking. So I just cut alcohol out completely. If I want to get calories, I want to get it done through something unhealthy food-wise, not a beer, which is the same amount of calories as a piece of cake. So I don't drink. I've never been a big fan of alcohol. I just cut that out completely. I don't drink coffee. I don't have to artificially simulate myself, I should say. So I'm sort of the ultimate in terms of boredom. Don't drink, don't take drugs, don't smoke, don't drink coffee. Probably to one extreme, if I'm going to drink a hot drink, it's generally the green tea. So I find that allows me to be super active. I never have an issue getting up. Really great for sleeping because of the no caffeine thing. I'm not saying this is for everyone, but I think a really easy one is dropping the alcohol. I think this is more and more common from the younger Instagram generation who are now, I'm now 42, and when I was young, to be cool, you needed to drink 15 beers at a footy function and then go to a nightclub and sink another few more, and that's what made you cool. These days, thankfully, I think people under the age of 25 are smart enough to realize that doesn't make you cool. It makes you unhealthy, and it makes your life harder, not easier. So seeing sort of younger, and I say work with a lot of young founders, many of whom don't drink. So I think if you can reduce or drop the alcohol, you're much better off for it, both weight-wise, health-wise, sleep-wise. And it's a really easy shortcut. And I think getting up early is a good one. Don't have to get up at 5, get up at 6, but just get your exercise done early. And certainly try fasting. I don't eat meat either. My wife became a vegan a couple of years ago, about 3 years ago. I, despite loving meat myself, there's now so many great alternatives. So I stopped eating meat. Watch Game Changers if you haven't done it. One of the greatest docos you'll ever watch. The upside performance-wise, I'm not eating meat, is significant. Many of the world's best athletes, especially best endurance runners, none of whom eat meat. I start running my best half marathon times and marathon times. I got sort of 4.5 minute marathon Ks. Since I stopped eating meat, I used to be sort of around 5 minutes. I took about 10% off. So it was really helpful there. So it was a great benefit to performance. So whether you do one, none, or all those things, I think the top one would be no drinking. Second one, if you can reduce or completely remove meat from diet, you'll see a great benefit in performance, digestion, just feeling lighter. All little things, little body hacks that certainly help me. Not great, not perfect for everyone, but it certainly has worked for me, and it's allowed me to be super active sort of for 18 hours a day, 365 days a year. But good luck on your journey, and congratulations, and thanks for your question. And that's it for this edition of Ask Adam Anything. Thanks so much for your questions. If you'd like to submit a question, please send a voice recording to info@fromzeropodcast.com. If you're a founder, young professional, or just someone interested in the world of business, please get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. Our producers are Lindsay Green and Ed Gooden. And this has been From Zero Podcast with me, Adam Schwab. Listener.